these hooligans were singing genocidal songs. When Jews say and Holocaust survivors say never again, the true Jews, the true Holocaust survivors that have are saying it never again about anybody, never again to anybody. And what these hooligans are saying are again and again, we will kill civilians. Again and again, we will kill children. Again and again, we will kill women. And we're proud of it, and we will sing about it. And so what did they do? Every news media, and please, we must boycott CNN. We must boycott NPR. NPR, by the way, has been complicit in supporting and collecting intelligence for the Israelis. An NPR reporter recently was collaborating with the Israeli authorities and trying to incite a civil war when she reported about a Christian Lebanese standing guard in Ashrafieh, a place where there is no Hezbollah, but they were checking to make sure that there is no Hezbollah, there is no Lebanese resistance there, because they're protecting their neighborhood. This is NPR reporting, right? Because this reporter knows that she's aiding the Israeli military, which is losing the ground war, and therefore they want to start a civil war. And that's those kinds of reports provoke sectarian violence and promote sectarian violence. But it's not going to work. It never worked and won't work. But we need to expose these reporters. We need to confront them. We need to shut down NPR station. We need to besiege them until they start stop their collaboration with the IDF, with the most hated military in the world. These days, when after the fog of war settles, NPR should be one of the primary targets that we have to reclaim our public airwaves from these corporations and from the military-industrial complex and from the US government propaganda and from Israeli propaganda. We need to liberate our national public radio from that. Because if you look at how they report on cultural events and how accurate they are, and you look at the responsibility that with which they handle news about the Arab world, they are a bunch of racist and Islamophobes. And I've talked with producers who have regurgitated those kinds of lies, justifying the occupation of Jerusalem, justifying the expansion into the West Bank, justifying everything that Israel does. That's the role of NPR. That's the role of CNN. And look at how CNN and NBC and CBS and even Sky, which reported the truth at first about what happened in Amsterdam, and then they started to reported to reverse the reporting of the truth. Lastly, I wanted to let you know that tonight I will be moderating a teach-in on Lebanon that tells the truth and counters what NPR is trying to do and counters what CNN is trying to do. This is because Rania Khalik, who is a Lebanese reporter, will be on tonight at Busboys and Poets at 14th Street, near U Street. That Busboys and Poets, she's a journalist coming in from Lebanon to report of what's really happening on the ground, and I'll be moderating it. And that'll be at 8:30 p.m. Tonight, at Busboys and Poets. And with that, I'd like to introduce the Dig episode. That's an interview with Dr. Kienga, that she did. And also, I would urge you to check her talk that she did with Ta-Nehisi Coates and Noura Erekat at the Riverside Church, that where Martin Luther King once stood against the Vietnam War. It's one of the best talks where all of them, all of these three, stand against the war that's existing right now, and against the U.S. government that's.
Hope, a digital magazine of race, culture, and politics. She's the author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation and a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. Yamada Taylor, welcome back to The Dig.
Thank you. Great to be here. Sort of.
Yeah, caveat, asterisks. I'm thinking back a lot to 2016 when the big story was white working class voters shifting hard to Trump. And we can, I think, all really clearly remember the elite liberal refrain that these uneducated white people were just racists, plain and simple, and that was the sort of explanation for Trumpism. And racism, of course, played a role. It always plays a role here in the United States of America. That's not novel. But today, after 2020, and then Harris's loss this week, it's really abundantly clear that this class realignment from the Democratic Party is a multiracial phenomenon. What's your diagnosis? What's driving this class realignment, and why does the Democratic Party seem totally incapable of confronting it?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One, I think, is important to say because there's still pockets. It's been less pronounced than 2016, but there's still pockets of people who are going on about white women, and white people did this, and I think that it's really important to kind of unpack what happened and who voted and what this is about. Trump's support among white people in general has gone down. The problem is that the bottom of the Democratic Party literally fell out. And so I wrote in my magazine, Hammer and Hope, that the biggest problem for the Democratic Party was not necessarily the defection of black men to Trump, although I'll come back to that, but was the indifference to the election itself, meaning that Trump wasn't the biggest competition, it was the couch. Were people motivated enough to get up and go and deal with, all of the nonsense of what it has become to vote in this country? And so I don't know exactly who voted in 2020 and didn't vote in 2024. There's still a lot of parsing through the exit data to get the full picture. Now, saying that, it is important to talk about the defections where they happened among Latino men and black men in particular. One of the things that has been missing from the discussion about the Democratic Party's campaign over the last few months is the way that the party was systematically missing the extent to which people are in crisis in the U.S. And this is, the heart of Joe Biden's insistence that he remain in the race was that he had turned the economy around. And by all conventional measures, the American economy was doing well. Unemployment historically low, poverty low for African Americans. Poverty, the rate at which people are living in poverty is at historic lows. Biden was correct that the rate of inflation had precipitously declined. I think it's at around 2.1 now. Problem, falling rates of inflation are not falling prices. It just means the rate at which prices are rising has slowed down. And so we are still stuck with the whether it's price gouging, whether it's inflation, whatever it is, the resting place of these prices are really out of whack with what people's incomes are, especially when you take into consideration that the nest eggs that people had amassed through the COVID payments, whether it was enhanced unemployment, whether it was the stimulus checks, whatever it was, being at home, not having to pay for gas, rent moratorium, people were able to store away money. That money's gone. That money's gone. Savings over the summer began to dip as low as they had in the recession of 2008. And so the Democratic Party seemed to have no consciousness of this. And so how does this economic picture play out in real life? Well, 2023 to 2024, a historic rise in homelessness that is on schedule to rise even higher this year, at the end of this year, 2024. Food insecurity, high. All of these kinds of barometers by which people measure the quality of their life pointed downward for working class people. Rent. Rent today is 20% higher than it was in 2020. There was a study on consumer debt that showed in the first quarter of this year, 2024, consumer debt had exceeded $17 trillion. So to the extent that people are holding their lives together, it's through credit cards, which, of course, we know is completely unsustainable. And so you can go through the statistics, you can go through all of these kinds of measurements that we can piece together what a working class person's life is like, and you contrast this to the platform and the promises, policies, whatever, that the Democratic Party has had on offer since their convention moving forward. And it's like they're living in a different universe. I mean, take yourself back to the DNC, to the Democratic National Convention, where the theme was joy. And not only was joy perverse in the midst of a genocide in Gaza, but even on the terms of what it means for American workers, the theme of joy is just not appropriate when people are facing homelessness, when people are facing housing insecurity, food insecurity, so on and so forth. And so there has been a kind of, I won't give them the benefit of saying that there's a kind of strategic fumble, because I think these are the politics of the Democratic Party, which is a hostility to an expansion of the welfare state, a hostility to the COVID welfare state that was quickly assembled and then just as quickly disassembled. But what it did was show ordinary people that actually it is possible to use the government to improve people's lives overnight. Like, you can literally do this overnight. And so I think that the Democratic Party, which paints itself as the party of working class people, the party of ordinary people, have not had a message to communicate that, because I just think it is not a part of their bag. I think there's an emotional resonance that this is what our history is. But when you look at what is actually on offer compared to what individuals are dealing with, there is a mismatch. And I think that the chickens have come home to roost with that. And we've seen the dramatic fallout. To lose the presidency, the Senate, most likely the House, is a dramatic condemnation of the Democratic Party strategy.
Yeah, I think we can't overstate the centrality of the housing crisis amid the larger cost of living crisis, amid a half century long process of neoliberal economic restructuring, which has had a dramatic political impact, which I think even the Biden administration started to realize in some ways in terms of thinking through things like the Inflation Reduction Act, rebuilding labor movement. This will rebuild the base that the Democratic Party needs to win, and that had been eviscerated under the Obama and Clinton administrations. And yet, even though Biden in these certain ways departed from neoliberal orthodoxy, he was still so constrained by neoliberal orthodoxy, and that amidst a cost of living crisis, he could not consider price controls.
Nixonian.
Once very normal in the United States. They were off the table. We didn't see, we didn't see any, we saw zero concerted effort from the White House down from mainstream Democrats to deal with the housing crisis by pursuing rent control. And as you just pointed out, all of this on the heels of Americans during the pandemic getting this glimpse of what a modest social democracy might look like. Oh, damn, the government can just give me things that
I need. And it was extremely popular.
And then they took it away.
And they took it away. Well, I think it's important to point out that in 2020, because there were 26 million people marching in the streets, exerting unprecedented pressure on the Democratic Party, that Joe Biden was forced to go from having said in the fall of 2019 during at the beginning of the primary season, telling donors that not much would change if I were to become president, to him having to change everything during the course of that election to try to transform activism in the streets into votes for him. And in doing so, the Democratic Party made big promises. And I think it's worth, you know, I mean, we can go through the platform, the Democratic Party platform that was turned over to activists to basically rewrite in the summer of 2020. The promises to cancel student debt, to pay for family leave, to invest money in childcare, on and on and on. And what happened?
Opposing regime change in Iran.
Yes.
That went out the window.
And what happened in the midst of all these promises? They won more votes than in any other presidential election in American history. So to go from that to conclude with Kamala Harris that we need to run away from that, that we need to dump all of that, is absurd and really politically insane. You know, the Biden administration then, in an effort to rescue the economy that had been sidelined because of COVID and the demands that people stay at home, also had to enact these dramatic reforms with the American Rescue Plan that was really effective. And again, demonstrated to people that this kind of government investment to make people's lives better is good, is popular. And even if you look today at polls that Pew did a bunch of polls about investment in government, you know, is it for the good? Is it for the worse because we might go into debt? Consistently, large majorities support government involvement in healthcare, government use of resources to mitigate poverty, government resources to ensure that people have housing, government resources to ensure that people have childcare. People want investments in their schools. So it's not like this developing narrative now that, oh, Americans are just right wing and Trump gives them what they want. And, you know, what do they want? They just want to be angry and lash out. It's actually not that. That people want reform. And the Democratic Party runs away from reform and don't, you know, have spent the better part of two generations trying to disconnect themselves from the legacy of an earlier era of reform. And so they don't actually champion these policies. They champion, you know, horrible kind of public-private partnership programs that mimic what, you know, real reform would look like. But they don't want to be seen as a party pushing for the resumption of any kind of welfare state. So it means that they're a party with a muddled message, whether it's Joe Biden and searching for the soul of America or whatever the hell he described it as in 2020, or Kamala Harris and we're the party of joy and freedom, whatever that means, in a time of extreme political and economic crisis.
And we saw support for government action to raise wages as well, these minimum wage referenda that passed in so many red states this week. And we as a left, I think something that we always point to and that you're rightfully pointing to here is that we have majority support on so many of our core issues. But what we failed to do so far is to create a bigger story, a bigger narrative, a new form of common sense, something that makes this all compelling as a package, as a cohesive form of politics that people will identify with. If we could run all of our left platform as referenda simultaneously throughout the nation, we'd have social democracy, if not socialism, overnight. But that's not how it works. We need to construct some sort of cohesive political package that appeals to majority, and that's what we haven't figured out.
That's the big hole. That's the big vacuum. It can be described as the distance between what people want and the method, the vessel, the vehicle by which we can achieve that. The Democratic Party has always posited itself like that, at least since the three quarters of the 20th century. But I think, you know, in some ways, the end of Obama's presidency marked a certain finality in a certain kind of liberalism or a certain kind of belief in liberalism. And I think that this failed campaign of Kamala Harris really closes the coffin on that. It doesn't mean that the Democratic Party is dead. I mean, I think we can all remember, I remember the summer of 2015 when the Republican Party was the laughingstock of the world because they seemed to be serious about putting Donald Trump forward as a presidential campaign. And so in a matter of, you know, fewer than 10 years, I think, you know, by the time he is inaugurated in January, it will be 10 years from laughingstock to the most powerful political power party in the world. In the two-party system, your fortunes can change very quickly. But I think there's a structural problem that the Democrats have in that the working class base of the party, the core constituencies, are leeching from the party. And that, to me, is, you know, the most dramatic storyline of this presidential contest is, again, when you look at the exit polls, the $30,000 to $50,000, like solid working class range of voters, majority go to Trump, right? Under $100,000, the majority go to Trump. It was Kamala Harris who won the big money, you know, in the U.S. context, $100,000, $200,000 earners, the 200,000 plus earners. Those, the majority of those voters went to Kamala Harris. If you look at white workers without a college degree, vast majority of them go to Trump. It is true that most black workers without a college degree went to Harris. And so the sort of base of the Democratic Party is being frittered away. And it's significant portions of it are going to the Republican Party. And then other parts of it have just been left to float away into the ether because no one represents what it is that they want. So this is a structural problem for the Democratic Party. How will they reconstitute a electoral coalition that can give them an ability to compete in these races? And based on the kind of political framework that they are putting forward, which is vapid, vacuous commentary that is nothing speak. And you just think about,
I think the vacuousness is really a big part of it. Poll testing everything that you say, it comes across to people as insincere.
Because it is. They just spent in Philadelphia, what has been described as the poorest of the big cities, for more than a decade. The last two weekends, they've been having rock concerts at the downtown, the steps of the Philadelphia Museum, Kamala Harris shouting out Rocky Balboa statue, that this is the city of under, like, what are you doing? There's a housing crisis in Philadelphia. There is a crisis of poverty in Philadelphia. There are dramatically underfunded public schools in Philadelphia. And the Democrats come rolling in with the celebrities, with the high rollers, and they have nothing to say about any of that except get out the vote. It is an embarrassment. And people pick up on that. And that, to me,
it's insulting to people's intelligence.
It's absolutely insulting people's intelligence. There's that. There is the condescension and arrogance. Barack Obama. So there are two things with Obama. One is I saw this ad on Instagram last week, and it was a young Latino man in his 20s saying, you know, how do you figure out who to vote for? And so there's Barack Obama. And he says, well, you probably look in your neighborhood and it doesn't look like much has changed, I'm sure. But what you don't see is that one of your neighbors has a prescription that she didn't have before. And some other neighbor has a bag of groceries that they didn't have before. And so what you have to understand is that change is incremental. And what you really need to base your vote on is, do you like the person? Do you trust them? And it's just like, what are you talking about? First, it's the low expectations, right? That these people tell us these are the most consequential elections of our lifetimes, and yet we shouldn't expect much. And the mismatch between the low expectations and the idea that change is only incremental, but the rent's not incremental, right? The cost of living that changes from one year to the next is not incremental. And so there's that, but then there's just the lecturing from Barack Obama, either in this situation, there are all the clips of him telling Muslims to, you know, don't bite your nose off to spite your face, lecturing to Black men that any economic concerns that they have don't exist, that actually it's just sexism. And so there's the condescension of the Democratic Party. There's the elitism of the Democratic Party. And you combine all of this with their absolute inability to change anything on a national level and then on a local level. And so what people have is continuity from one administration to the next. The same sorts of conditions that exist under an Obama administration, exist under a Trump administration, exist under a Biden administration. And so it does feel like, what's the point? What is the point of going out to vote for this or that politician when not much changes for the good in my everyday life? And so I think that there are many different factors that they're going to have to overcome to reconstitute a voting coalition if they have any hope of being relevant in the near future electorally.
We see all these liberal pundits who are saying it's not Kamala's fault, it's the American people's fault, which brings to mind that great Brecht line about dissolving the people and electing the other, another. Like, unfortunately, like in an electoral democracy, you actually have to win people's votes, and they don't take well to being condescended to. And that's not just amongst, you know, the super party elite in white middle class neighborhoods right adjacent to where I live in Rhode Island. I see these signs everywhere that say Harris Walls, obviously. And I don't know if you've seen them around. It's unreal, but it also feels sort of exemplary.
Yeah.
Of a problem. And there's a clip circulating in recent days from the late David Graeber where he argues that there's some kind of like sick dialectic connection between this sort of elite liberal smugness that really prioritizes feeling good about oneself and virtue signaling, and then these clown cartoon scam artists, you know, playing dumb on the right.
Yes. No, I mean, I think there's the playing dumb from the Yalies that is always hilarious and frightening and disgusting to watch. I think one of the things that I've been thinking about and I think that we should talk about is I talked about this with my class. I have a class of freshmen, and I was wondering, you know, what their reaction would be. I remember in 2017 or 2016, the reaction was pretty much like someone had been killed, you know, like shock, terror, complete overwhelm and bewilderment. But I think for these young people, they've grown up with Trump as a political figure, where, you know, we grew up with Trump as an entertainer, as a kind of buffoon, as part of a seedy popular culture in the United States, which enhanced the shock value of him becoming president. Where for these students of mine, he seems like just a weird kind of unhinged right-wing politician. But one of the things that I think is important to point to is the way that I do think Trump's anger and disgust resonates with people in this artificial world of mainstream politics from either Democrats or Republicans. And there's a way, because Trump isn't offering any plausible solution to those economic issues either. It's not like, oh, well, actually, Trump has the coherent economic plan. His plan for housing is I'm going to deport 11 million people and you can live in the places they used to live in. I mean, it's absurd. You know, it's dangerous and disgusting, but it is completely, you know, nonsensical and absurd. So it's not like people are looking at two columns of, you know, oh, what is the Trump policy platform offering? It's not that, but it is a kind of thumb in the eye, the finger, and, you know, just kind of an F you to the status quo that I think even if you're not getting anything in return, there's some kind of strange satisfaction in having stuck it to these suits, the scolds, the people who have figured it all out and are here to tell you that you owe them your vote. And so, because there's an aspect of this that is beyond just the kind of bread and butter policy discussion, there's something so stifling and gross about American politics. We think about Trump's rambling rally speeches where people are streaming out. They don't make any sense. And yet they're not the canned political speech that Kamala Harris, Tim Walz offer, that by the 17th time, we knew all of the applause lines. We knew all of the inflections. We knew exactly what they were going to say. And so that is also, I think, a part of the Democratic Party, a part of their political crisis, is that they are the establishment. They are the status quo. And people are tired of that. And they're sick of that because they equate that with the kind of continuity in the conditions of their everyday lives.
And I think Democrats protecting a status quo that so many people want to destroy, mm-hmm. and yet replaying 2016's status quo protection campaign to the ends that we've seen that run this week. I think it's related to which voters the Democratic Party is pursuing. And Democrats, I think, would like to believe that their strategy of courting anti-Trump Republicans, affluent professionals and suburbanites, that this is somehow unrelated to them losing working class voters. But I think they're obviously related. Courting one for so many reasons entails losing the latter. And it's a process, something I discussed with historian Lily Geismer I think a couple years ago, that really took off under the Clinton administration. This is a political choice that entails certain policy choices. Could a multiracial working class be won over to a populist social democratic candidacy that was oriented towards class conflict? And is the basic problem that the Democratic Party, as it's currently constituted, can't do that because they can't wage class conflict against the very elites that they're pursuing as their base?
I think we got a glimpse of that potential. I think the first glimpse of that was 2016 with Bernie Sanders' surprise run. And even though that first run, you know, people criticized Bernie for not having a particularly refined message about the problems of racism in American society. And so we didn't necessarily see the kind of full, I think the campaign was truncated by the end of the primary season before we could see the full integration of like young Black people who were certainly attracted to his political message and the economic reforms that he was championing. But by 2020, clearly Sanders' campaign represented a totally different future for the Democratic Party. It represented the kind of political coalition that we salivate over now, because it did represent the multiracial political movement that I think has all the potential in the world. I mean, we can see the potential, to me, we can see the potential more clearly now than in the last 50 years. The kind of mutual evisceration of Black, white, and Latino life in this country that's played out. I mean, we could talk about the economic categories or statistics. There, the other measurements, you know, the study about the deaths of working class white people that came out right before the pandemic, the so-called deaths by despair, in which ordinary white working class people without college degrees were dying of drug addiction, opioid addiction, alcoholism, and suicide. And you map that with what has happened post-pandemic, through the pandemic to now with Black working class people, the rate at which white people were dying quicker, apparently, according to the study, Black working class people have caught up with them. And so the mutual immiseration of the lives of the multiracial working class absolutely lays the political foundation for a movement of that sort. And the problem is not that that potential doesn't exist, is that the problem is that it has not been a part of any real political initiative in the U.S. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about is how a movement like Black Lives Matter, which was so important in terms of raising the profile of the impact of racism in the lives of Black people in this country, in ways that is even hard to appreciate now because it's become such an accepted and understood aspect of life for Black people in the United States. If you think about that 10 years, 13, 14, 15 years earlier, where there's really an absence of discussion about the impacts of racism in the lives of Black people. And so Black Lives Matter plays a very important role in doing that. And one of the other things that the best parts of the movement did was demonstrate how the working class character of Black life is part of what made Black people vulnerable to policing and to the overrepresentation of Black people in the criminal legal system. And so the problem, though, is that a movement focused purely or exclusively on the lives of Black people actually doesn't have the social capacity to transform those conditions that make Black people vulnerable to policing in the first place. So if we say that social inequality, economic inequality, is part is at the center of that vulnerability, then it actually takes a mass movement to transform that. And a movement that defines itself as Black Lives Matter is not the vehicle that can actually build. The radicalization of white people and transform that into politics as well. So we saw in 2020, one of the reasons why the backlash was triggered was because of the radicalization of young white people, because millions of white people were marching against racism, sometimes in places where there were no black people. And we have a left that often responds so cynically to that. Right? Like, oh, what do you want, a cookie for fighting racism? And it's like, no, people don't want cookies for fighting racism. But like, this is an important development in our political movement to try to build the type of mass movement that's necessary to change the social and political conditions that are disproportionately affecting Black people, but that are affecting the entire working class and poor people in this country. And so that's the kind of vehicle that we need to organize and to build. And without that, what we're seeing is that the Republicans have tried to step successfully into that political vacuum, right? Like they do. I mean, we can say that Trump's political platform, his policy platform, his economic plans are ridiculous and make no sense. But what the Republicans are doing is offering a narrative to explain why your life chances, your quality of life have gone into the toilet. We're going to offer you an explanation. We're going to blame immigrants for doing that. And we're going to blame crime. You know, we're going to offer an explanation for this. The Democrats don't have an explanation for why this has happened. And so there's an incredible, and the left,
they don't have an explanation because they don't have an enemy. Because the enemy the base that they're hoping to have.
No, absolutely. This is a political problem. And the left, there's some parts of it that try to relate to the anger and despair of working class people. But often it's turned into, you know, the discourse of white privilege, which just sounds ridiculous when you look at the absolute destruction of working class white life in this country. There's the other part of the left that, you know, will crucify you if you say the.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Congress opened its lame duck session yesterday, and Senate Democrats are racing to confirm up to 30 federal judges nominated by Joe Biden to avoid leaving vacancies that could be filled by Donald Trump with his own more conservative nominees when he retakes the White House. In the Times Magazine op-ed last week, Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote, quote, "Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer must use every minute of the end of the year legislative session to confirm federal judges and key regulators, none of whom can be removed by the next president," close quote. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is urging GOP senators to block any nominations of Biden appointees before he takes office. He wrote on Truth Social over the weekend, "No judges should be approved during this period of time," close quote. In related news, Republicans this morning elected South Dakota Senator John Thune as the new Senate Majority Leader, replacing longtime leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Thune, a more traditional Republican in his fourth Senate term, has promised to work closely with incoming President Donald Trump, despite sometimes opposing him in the past. Thune publicly broke with Trump over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election, but in recent months has realigned himself with the former president. Thune's competitors in the secret ballot were Senators John Cornyn of Texas and Rick Scott of Florida. Scott ran a non-traditional bid for the Senate leadership position, winning endorsements from people outside the chamber, including Trump ally Elon Musk. In other news, the Biden administration said yesterday it will not change its policy on arms transfers to Israel after a deadline expired for Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza. In an October 13 letter, the Biden administration told Israel that it had to take specific steps to improve the aid situation within 30 days or face restrictions on U.S. military aid. Speaking to reporters yesterday, State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vandant Patel repeatedly declined to say if the criteria had been fulfilled, but also that Israel had taken steps to address the demands and that Washington would continue to assess the situation. On Monday, 8 international aid groups said Israel had failed to meet the U.S. demands to improve access for assistance, and a UN-backed report recently warned that there was an imminent likelihood of famine in northern Gaza, where hardly any aid has entered in the past month. And Roy Haynes, the legendary drummer from jazz's swing and bebop eras, has died at 99 after a brief illness. Roy Haynes was born in Boston on March 13, 1925, and started his musical career in 1942 as a largely self-taught drummer. He spanned various jazz styles from swing and bebop to fusion and avant-garde. He went on to work with some of the biggest names in jazz, including John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, and Miles Davis. Haynes would go on to win 2 Grammy Awards and was nominated a further 8 times over his masterful career. And in weather today in New York City, it is 50 degrees and sunny. In Washington,